The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We'll wait for a couple of minutes to allow everybody to come in.
Yes.
I think it's a combination.
Three equal.
Yes, and there are a few apparently who are not from this law school.
Okay.
Really?
That's great.
So I see, I know some of the names.
Yeah, I can see, that's why I'm thinking.
You see what?
Some of the names I know.
Oh, okay.
You know, this is my wife.
Who? Macarena.
She
coming? To say hi to you?
No.
Okay, are we ready? He's on his way. Okay, good afternoon to all. You are most welcome, and thank you very much for coming to this panel on careers in arbitration. I am Horacio Grigera Naon. I am the director of the International Arbitration Program of this College of Law. And the purpose of our session today is to freely exchange ideas with you on how to get acquainted with international commercial arbitration and how to get started on a career in international commercial arbitration. Of course, one way of doing that is to start learning about arbitration in a specialized way. There are very few law schools in the world where they have a specialized program on international commercial arbitration, and the Washington College of Law is one of them, and possibly the only one in the United States of America. Our program has two annual seminars. One is a summer seminar that starts this year on the 29th of May and goes through the middle of June. And we offer five different one-credit courses on international arbitration. One of these courses is an introduction, which is called Nuts and Bolts of International Commercial Arbitration. Then we have more specialized courses. We have a course on choice of law and international arbitration, a course on ICC arbitration, that is to say the arbitration system of the International Chamber of Commerce, which is the most popular international commercial arbitration system in the world, based in Paris, with a caseload of about 1,300 cases at all times, and a flow of new cases of about 600 cases every year. Then we have, of course, a course on bilateral investment treaty arbitration. We have two experts who are on my right-hand side in bilateral investment treaty arbitration. And then we have, last but by no means least, a course for teaching you skills on how to run a hearing, an arbitral hearing, how to gather evidence in arbitration, how to present your case, how to win your case, and how not to lose your case. And then in October of 2006, we are having once more our mock case arbitration seminar. It's a four-day seminar. Each year we run it around a mock case which deals with a specific industry or economic or commercial activity that is normally the subject matter of international arbitration cases. The first year we ran a construction case under the ICC International Commercial Arbitration Rules. The second year we did also a construction case, but this time under the American Arbitration Association International Center for Dispute Resolution Rules. And this year we will have the pleasure of having a mock case on a bilateral investment treaty arbitration, which is going to be conducted under the rules of ICSID, the International Center for Investment Disputes, for the Resolution of Investment Disputes. So this is, of course, a very broad view of what we are doing in our program. And one of the objectives of our program is exactly doing what we are attempting to do today. That is to say, not just to share experiences, not just to teach arbitration, but to open up ways for you to get introduced into this exciting field of the law. international commercial arbitration has become the regular and normal means of dispute settlement of international economic and commercial disputes. It is not any longer a choice between courts of law belonging to different states. Now it is international arbitration that is the name of the game when it comes to dispute resolution. Without further ado, I am going to invite the first of our speakers, who is Jennifer Toole. She's an attorney advisor at the U.S. Department of State and a graduate from this law school. She graduated from the University of California at Berkeley in 1994 with a Bachelor of Arts degree, and then, of course, she obtained her J.D. degree from the Washington College of Law. And she's an expert in many things, but specifically in investment arbitration dispute. Ms. Toole?
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come back to AU to speak to students about careers in arbitration. I have been with the State Department as an attorney advisor for the past 4.5 years. I started in the treaty office as an extern, and I soon thereafter obtained a position in the Office of International Claims and Investment Disputes as a law clerk, and I don't mean to point you out, but we have one of our law clerks here today, Eve Hope, sitting in the audience. She's kind of following my path. I did that for 1.5 years for my second year and third year. And then upon graduation, I was offered a position with the NASA Investor State Arbitration Team at the State Department. And just recently, I've taken on some different responsibilities in the office, which also include arbitration, which is the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal arbitrations, which is state-to-state arbitration. So I wanted to talk very briefly about the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal. And then spend a little more time on the NAFTA Investor State Arbitration, and then give you some advice about how you can go about obtaining a career in this field. Now, the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal jurisprudence has been very influential in investor state arbitration, even though it was a treaty signed by two governments following the hostage-taking in Iran. Prior to those events, Iran was a place that was very attractive for investment because of its vast oil wealth and other reasons. It was a huge consumer of defense articles. Many, many, many U.S. companies invested in that territory. And following the revolution and the overthrow of the Shah, you can imagine that those investments that were made in Iran, those interests were harmed. And so as part of the Algiers Accords, which were signed in order to resolve disputes between the United States and Iran, those private investors were given the opportunity to be compensated for those losses. And so, as I mentioned, that jurisprudence has proved to be very influential in future investment agreements, which gave opportunities to investors to pursue remedies for any sort of harm to their property interests. So I'm going to move into the NAFTA investor state arbitration field now. Dr. Gregara-Neon mentioned that we were investment arbitration experts, and I know NAFTA is a free trade agreement, but it's a free trade agreement with an investment chapter, with a bilateral investment treaty inserted into it. And what it does is it accords certain protections to investors that, like, for example, a Canadian investor who makes an investment in the United States territory, or a United States investor that makes an investment in Mexico. And if there is a breach of the treaty, then these investors actually have standing, instead of turning to their own governments to try to espouse their claim, they have standing to bring a claim directly. And so thus far, we've had a number of claims brought against the United States, and I've been on the team defending those claims. Our claims have ranged from disputes over procurement requirements for steel to a Mississippi trial to California regulations of gasoline additives. We've so far been very lucky in the fact, well, I don't know if you want to call it luck or skill, but we've so far managed to be victorious with the cases thus far. There are a number of cases pending. Those involve the softwood lumber dispute with Canada, the restrictions on Canadian cattle due to mad cow disease. There's one that involves regulations in California restricting certain mining activities. So you can see that there's a wide range of issues that arise in this practice. And so as a lawyer in this field, what you end up having to do is not only just develop expertise in the law of the treaty, so to speak, what are the substantive protections that you provide, but you have to, as a matter of fact, become familiar with the laws of the laws that are being challenged, so to speak. Like if it's a regulation that's being challenged, you need to become familiar with that industry. So we've had to become familiar with how gasoline additives are manufactured and that sort of thing. And let me see. So what an investor state attorney does is very similar to what a litigator would do. It involves writing briefs, oral argument, witness preparation. Where it departs from that is one thing that we get to do, and I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with alternative dispute resolution. In my experience with the NAFTA cases, we have provisions that allow us to select arbitrators. So part of my role is to look into who do we want to decide these cases, because these are ad hoc tribunals. There's not a sitting court to decide these cases, so that's part of the job. Another thing that we need to do is monitor the other NAFTA cases, so the disputes against Mexico, the disputes against Canada, because one thing that we can do in the treaty is if we are concerned that the interpretation of the treaty needs to be correct in a particular case and that there might be some confusion, then we will provide an interpretation to that tribunal. We don't comment on the facts of those cases, but we do have the opportunity to comment on what the proper interpretation of the treaty is. And then also because I work with the government and because in defending these cases, we've learned where these sort, not just the NAFTA, but where maybe bilateral investment treaties may be unclear, we've learned through experience how to advise negotiators of bilateral investment treaties on what language is appropriate in their negotiations. So that's the sort of thing. And so now I want to talk to you a little bit about how to go about getting a job in this field. And my story is rather unconventional, I think. And I don't know that it would be your story, but there are some things that you can learn from my story. The first thing, as I mentioned, I worked at the State Department when I graduated, before I graduated, as a law student. And I was told, you know, and we have to say this to everyone, we said this to Eve as well, is that you aren't guaranteed a position when you apply. But nonetheless, when I was offered that position, I still wanted to take it because I knew it would be good experience. And that's what I would suggest to you is even if you don't have a guarantee of future employment, while you're a student, I would search out opportunities in the field and just get that experience. And so that's what I chose to do. And at that time, I knew nothing about this field at all. So that's another thing that I would express to you is you might find yourself, you know, pursuing one thing but then yet fall into another and that you really enjoy. And what happened on my very first day is I was asked to research the finality issue in Lowen. I don't know if you two are familiar with this. With very little guidance and was sent to the library to look at some very dusty books, but I was able to perform, and I kind of became the NAFTA clerk of the office. So when there was a NAFTA project in the office, it was assigned to me. And that's another thing that I would recommend is that you work really hard when you get that position. It doesn't matter if you're going to have an offer at the end of the day. You want to make the best possible impression because at the end of the day, you want a good recommendation. So I did do that, developed expertise in the area. It came time to graduate, and it really was just fate. But when I was looking to graduate, they were looking to hire someone entry level, And what do you know, here's a student in this field, which was in its infancy, who's developed some expertise in the area. And so obviously I was the most logical person for the job. They opened the job up, because they have to do that. But there weren't really any applicants out there just coming out of school with my background. And so when you go into this field and you get a, if you can get an opportunity while you're still in school and can develop an expertise and make yourself indispensable to that office, they might decide to bend the policy and let you come in through that back door, so to speak. But there are other things that you can do. One of the things, nowadays, it's a lot more competitive in the field. If I was just graduating from law school, even though I had that NAFTA experience, there might be many students that have been researching in the area. So what I would suggest that you do is learn as much as you can about the subject and write some articles about the subject so that you can speak intelligently about it. Right now, we're doing interviews for law clerks, and honestly, some people can speak intelligently about things. I'm very impressed with them. They know what they're talking about, while others, they just kind of have this vague interest in international law. I'm not necessarily going to be interested in bringing that person in. And you don't obviously have to go work in government. You can work in law firms. You can work in NGOs. There's a lot of NGOs will, well, I shouldn't say a lot, but a few NGOs have submitted amicus submissions in these cases, and so that's an opportunity. There's always ICSID, right? So there's a lot of different avenues that you can travel to get to this place. And my final piece of advice is you don't necessarily have to get a job in the field right away, but keep your interest. So let's say you get just a general litigation type position. Continue to read up on the field, write some articles, show that you're interested, and if you get that litigation background and then you've shown that you actually have this interest in the field, then down the road, once you have a little more experience, you might be able to be attractive to a future employer in the field. I have a friend who was working at the Department of Commerce, and she eventually got involved in some of the BIT negotiations, which ultimately led to a job at a law firm doing investor-state arbitration. So there are many different ways to get here, but you know, following my path exactly probably isn't going to be yours, as I mentioned, but that's all I have. So, thank
you so
again.
Much, Jennifer. Mm-hmm. I would like to introduce Professor Perry Wallace to you. Professor Wallace is a tenured professor of the Washington College of Law at the American University. He teaches corporate, environmental, and international law, which is a very interesting combination for international arbitration. But also he's an engineer, which is also at I think that Jennifer was referring to the additives to gasoline.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, in construction and in other industries, you need to have, I wouldn't say necessarily to be an expert. If you're an expert, it's all the best for you, all the better for you. But you need to have an insight into industries. And I'm sure that Professor Wallace, with all his experience, because he's also an experienced arbitrator, we are looking forward to your comments.
Thank you very much, Horacio, and good evening. I'm very happy to get to speak with you for just a very few minutes. I'd like to describe a little bit of my experience overall, and then talk about the arbitration experience in particular, and offer what thoughts I can about trying to get to work in the area. Well, first, my experience. I've had a rather strange life. I went to engineering school and ultimately did work in engineering. I played professional basketball, and which doesn't have it. Well, actually, it has a lot to do with disputes, if you think about it. more than it actually should. A lot of my work as an engineer occurred in the military, and my work involved nuclear weapons work and other work, that's some of which I'm not able to describe. After that, I went to law school and ultimately became a trial attorney and then a senior trial attorney at the United States Justice Department. And my work involved largely natural resources, environmental, and some commercial work in litigation. And it was there where I got some sense of the potential and the limits of litigation as a means of resolving disputes. at a point after that, I went into teaching and then had the opportunity to begin to do some arbitrations. This is way back in the 1980s. I started as an arbitrator and arbitrated for the American Arbitration Association, and ultimately moved into, because one of my areas is corporate law and finance, began to do arbitrations for the New York Stock Exchange and for the National Association of Securities Dealers. This involved, of course, investment portfolio investment disputes, and quite an interesting area. And over the years, we are all aware of the globalization in general, but the globalization of the capital markets. And I got a chance to see from the 1980s on through the market drop of the 1987 and on through the Enron Worldcom problems, and of course after any debacles of that sort, there's a flurry of arbitrations. Over the period, I got a chance to again reaffirm my own appreciation of the balance that arbitration offers in dispute resolution, the balance of flexibility and structure that can be especially powerful in attacking disputes in a modern age, and especially as we go across national boundaries where there are all manner of considerations to be taken into account. And there, the flexibility of arbitration, actually, I got a chance to see it become more and more useful. And again, as the capital markets began to globalize, we had these disputes that brought in types of cases that we just hadn't seen before. That, in essence, has been my experience. I want to just say a few words, make a few observations as you think about getting to work in the area. Nothing especially structured, and I guarantee you that there's nothing brilliant about this. But here are a few thoughts. One of the interesting things about alternative dispute resolution in this country is that there's still, amazingly, within the profession or the professions, there's still not enough appreciation of, one, the potential and the power of arbitration and mediation, and also the fact that it's a reality that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's coming to a theater near you. So, for example, so if you decide, and I appreciate the comments that were previously made, if you chose the route of litigation but decided to be more enlightened than many of the litigators along with you, then you will keep up with arbitration developments. You will do the CLE courses and the like. You will, going back chronologically in law school, take the courses, join the societies and so on and so forth, and appreciate the differences among the different alternative dispute resolution approaches, and be ready to volunteer. Be ready to take on the cases, because what's happening is that litigators are having to learn something about arbitration, but a lot of them have not understood that it really is emerging and they should truly get ready for it. You'll find a lot of people who will turn down opportunities to do arbitration when they really ought to jump on it. And so that's probably the core of my advice, just to understand both the power, the presence, and the emerging nature of arbitration as one of the dominant forms of alternative dispute resolution, and be positioned to take advantage of the opportunities.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Perry.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And last but not least, I would like to introduce to you Gonzalo Flores, a Chilean national. This is also a multinational panel. I come from Argentina, he comes from Chile, and we have two distinguished Americans on the panel. Gonzalo serves as senior counsel at the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, ICSID, which is the World Bank Group's organization which provides dispute resolution services for disputes involving private investors and states. And in that capacity, Mr. Flores has a broad experience in many ways, but one of them is acting as secretary to these tribunals. One way of getting exposed to arbitration is to be able to serve an international institution that is involved in international arbitrations, and those institutions allow you, little by little, to take on some responsibilities. And one of them, maybe the most fascinating of them at that stage, is to act as secretary to an international arbitral tribunal. Many of the great arbitrators of our time have been secretaries to international arbitral tribunals. And without further ado...
Thank you very much, Horacio. Following Jennifer and Professor Wallace, I'm going to try to structure this in very few minutes in the following way. First, I'm going to tell you what is it that I do, then how did I get to do it, and then how could you get to do the same thing I am doing right now, which, by the way, it's fascinating. I really love my job. Now, one caveat at the beginning. What I do is international investment arbitration, and a distinguished scholar recently reminded me that this is just a very tiny part of international arbitration. really, really tiny.
Somebody reminded me that?
Yeah, very recently.
Yes.
But this is an amazing area. As I like to say to people when I'm interviewing, we're developing international investment law in my office, which is, I'm not doing it, the arbitrators are doing it, but it's amazing, it's fascinating. You work with the best people in the world. So basically, what is it that I do? In a nutshell, if you go back to the 60s, if a foreign investor had a problem with a local, with the government, that the whole state where he had invested any amount of money, he had basically two options. He could go to local courts, which the investor, the company, may perceive as biased and not be totally neutral towards the dispute, or could ask their government to espouse an international claim before the International Court of Justice and an international tribunal, which may not be an appropriate avenue for political reasons, for lack of drive on the side of the government. There are many reasons why the investor would not feel comfortable in this venue. In these circumstances, in a number of occasions, these disgruntled investors would go to the World Bank, the president of the World Bank, and ask for their services as a mediator, as a conciliator. The president of the World Bank, A, didn't have the expertise on this special area, B, didn't have the time, there were other circumstances. So within the legal department of the World Bank at the time, the general counsel was Aaron Brockes, came this idea of creating a special center, special forum, where individuals, where investors may file a claim directly against the state for measures that they consider to be breaching their rights under different systems, sets of rules. So this is how ICSID is created in 1965. It's an international organization independent from the World Bank. It's part of the World Bank group, but it's an independent organization. Its mandate is established under a treaty, the International Convention on the Settlement of Investment Disputes, also known as the ICSID Convention. Right now, there are 143 countries that are contracting states of ICSID, and the main features of the system is that if a dispute arises against an investor and a state, with the caveat that it has to be the investor has to be a national or different state than the whole state, and it's an investment dispute, has to arise directly out of an investment, and it's a legal dispute, and both parties consent to settle this to arbitration, they can bring a case to ICSID, to this arbitration center. Now, what do? We administer the proceedings. We provide the facilities to arbitrate or conciliate. Conciliate, we have had 4 conciliations in 40 years, so not a big thing. But arbitrate these disputes directly without passing to the espousing of the claim by the state of the investor or going through local courts. Two very important features of the ICSID system. The disputes are decided not by the center, disputes by independent tribunals, usually appointed by agreement of the parties. Once an award is rendered in the ICSID context, when a final decision is rendered, each of the contracting states, each of these 143 contracting states, must recognize and enforce this award as if it was the decision of their highest court. So there's no need of a special proceeding for recognition of the award as it is the situation in international commercial arbitration. The other particular feature of ICSID is that you cannot challenge the final award, the final decisions in local courts. There's a proceeding for challenging final awards within the system, which is mostly what's called the annulment proceeding. But that's it. That's the alternative that the investor has under the system. So it's self-contained, protected from revision by from review by local courts. Now that is ICSID. ICSID has approximately 40 years. The first 35 years we had 30 cases, which is a very small number of cases. Today we have approximately 110 pending cases. So the number of cases has grown exponentially. The reason is, and in three words, arbitration is private justice. So you need the consent of both parties to bring the case to arbitration. Now, this consent does not need to be included in one contract, as was historically the practice. A state can provide an advance consent, for example, in an international treaty. And what happened in the late 80s and the 90s, that many countries in Eastern Europe, Latin America, started concluding bilateral investment treaties for the promotion and protection of foreign investment, treaties in which they included an advance consent to exit arbitration. To attract foreign capital, states would say, okay, bring the capital and we're going to guarantee a series of this treatment. And one of the guarantees that they offered was that if there was any dispute arising of this relationship between the investor and the state, this would not have to be settled in local courts, but could be brought to international arbitration before ICSID, as a very general rule. As I said, mid-90s, investors started realizing that they had this avenue to settle their disputes and start bringing cases to ICSID at a rather faster pace than before. So as I said, we have a large number of cases. I see some familiar faces who have heard this before, but just to let you know, when I started working in ICSID, I was handling two cases, and I was totally stressed with the responsibility of working in two international arbitration proceedings. Wow, it's amazing. Today, I think I'm secretary in 25 arbitration proceedings, and I'm overviewing another 25, and I'm not stressed anymore. So it's we have a lot of cases now, and we can live with it. Now, I think we got better at managing.
I hope so.
Now, and we like
they
it.
Administer some of ours.
many of your cases. Now, how did I get to do this, running against the time? When I started doing this, it was as exceptional as the story that Jennifer described. I was looking for a job in London, which is quite far away from Washington. And I called a friend here in Washington looking for somebody in London. And I said, oh, this is the address, by the way. Can you send me your resume? We're looking for somebody with background in common law and civil law who speaks English and Spanish. Sure, I sent my resume looking for a job in London, and I ended up working at ICSID. I was interviewed. Now, at that time, as I said, we have few cases, so I had the amazing privilege of having a lot of time to learn international arbitration, to be trained by Ibrahim Shihata, that some of you may know, who was General Counsel of the World Bank for 20 years and Secretary General for 17 years, and by Antonio Parra, who was the Deputy Secretary General of ICSID, one of the men who know most in the world about the system, who's my mentor. There was a lot of time to learn. You know, when I arrived at ICSID, I had no idea what ICSID was, but for a take-home exam that I took at Cornell University. That was my exposure to ICSID, but there was plenty of time to learn. Now, that's my experience. Times change. Some years down the lane, we have this huge case, very sensitive case, in French and Spanish. My French was poor, my French colleagues' Spanish was not good, so we have two secretaries working on the same case, but we needed somebody with fluent in Spanish and French who would help us with this. And we're looking through a pile of resumes. We don't find what we're looking for. Suddenly, out of the blue, we receive a paper from a student at the University of Geneva. She was doing her PhD on ICSID, and she's Mexican, and she sends a paper written in French. Bingo. We're not going to publish your paper, but we want to hire you. Then another one of my colleagues, her PhD was in international commercial arbitration in Latin America. Her PhD has been published. She did that in France. At La Sorbonne. So you see, how we get here was very different at different times. Now, today, when I look at a resume, when I'm interviewing somebody, unfortunately, I have to say, I don't have the time to hire Gonzalo Flores. I don't have the time to train Gonzalo Flores, as charming as he may be. I need to have more people, more experienced, more seasoned candidates, because we don't have the time. I'm working all the time. I'm basically playing ping pong with all these cases. And therefore, it is very important, if you're interested in the area, which I think it's an amazing area, you have to read, you have to go to conference, you have to take the courses that the opportunities that are given to you. Try to write papers. Try, as Jennifer said, try to speak intelligently about the subject. So if I come to interview, you want to know what? I mean, Lowen is something you could have read an article about the Lowen case in the New Yorker. There was a case on the New Yorker about it. So get involved, learn about the topic. That's my major advice. Now, that's a disadvantage. You have to know things that we didn't have to know at the time. More like three important decisions when I started. Now it's a huge body of law that you should know. At the same time, when I started working on this, there were like two jobs available. I would work for ICSID, two law firms that had one or two partners doing international investment arbitration. There were very few opportunities on the field. Today, there's a large number of firms that have open special departments on international investment arbitration. You have that possibility. As the number of cases increases, the number of claimants and the number of counsel for claimants increases. So you have more law firms in need to bring people that are experienced. You have the possibility of course, of ICSID, but we're a very small institution. So this, but still, when I started, we were four lawyers. Now we're 14 lawyers having cases. So that's another possibility that it's opening. Of course, you have the possibility of working for government. State Department has a very strong team of lawyers, and it's a very good place to work, as far as I understand. So again, it is more competitive, it is more complicated, but it's an area that is developing very strongly, and you have a lot of more opportunities today, especially here in Washington. There's a lot going on in Washington. We at ICSID, we're at the center of this area, so very big law firms around the world use their Washington-based offices to manage these cases. And another two last things that I'm going to say. Not only U.S. law firms are working on this field. Another development in the area is that law firms from all over the world are starting to participate in this process. And in this context, I think that aside from reading and studying and participating and going to conference and trying to write a paper, there is the element of languages, which is very, very useful. There's an element of going abroad, having a life, doing something else, understanding the world. This is a wonderful melt of public and private international law. You have to know many things, and you have to have experience. You have to do things. I know that American has a wonderful international programs, double degree programs, and it's not fair that I say this because my wife runs those programs, but I know that those are very good opportunities. But basically, try to think internationally. And again, this is a wonderful moment to jump into this particular field. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Gonzalo. Before opening us to the floor for questions, Gonzalo said that many important things, but one thing is very important. It is that bilateral investment treaty arbitration is very, how can I say, it's very much on the news, it's very visible, but it's a tiny part of international commercial arbitration. And all of the advice that you receive is extremely useful. But one of the ways to get into this area is to become a good international business lawyer. My experience as arbitrator is the best arbitrators or the best counsel are not necessarily the best litigators, are the best business lawyers, even in state party arbitration and even investment disputes. You have heard about international law, you have heard about investment, you have heard about construction, about international law, and this is just a part of the issues that are going to come to you if you're in this field. And without saying any more, we are open to questions. So it's
for you to put questions to us.
Can I just add one thing to that? Yeah, if you do deals, so to speak, and you are a business lawyer and you're involved with big infrastructure projects, for example, and just generating those investments and doing those deals, you're going to understand how that works so much better. I just wanted to add to that because the litigators just learn it for the particular case, but the person that's done that and understands how that works as an arbitrator, you're right, you're absolutely right. So I just wanted to agree with you. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
And if I may add one little thing, Horacio, you mentioned the investment contraction business. There is an area that's developing a very international features in arbitration, where the most distinguished arbitrators in the world are participating. It's a sports arbitration.
Oh, yes. Yes, I was going to refer. When Professor Wallace referred to basketball, he really put his finger on it. There is an international sports arbitration panel that resolves all of these kinds of disputes. So that's also true. Yes, sir.
I'm working with the CIS in Lausanne. I'm in a law firm in Rome, and actually I handle a lot of sports law. Litigation, and the rules actually are very similar to the ICC rules, and so that was the first time that I got involved into arbitration, and now I'm expanding a little bit also on ICC arbitration and AAA, and I'm trying to do. But the first contact that I had with arbitration, that's weird. I found myself working with sports law because I'm not a sportsman, I'm not a sports fan, but I found myself in one of the best firms in Italy that deals with sports law, and actually, yeah. We do lots of, and it's very, very closely related to arbitration, also commercial, because actually most of the disputes now are commercial disputes about contracts. There are lots of money going around, so it's growing bigger and bigger. And it's a very fascinating field, actually.
Okay, so you see an example of somebody who gets to arbitration by getting to work, doing legal work in connection with a specific activity. I started my career working for a multinational corporation based in Argentina. The main business they did was oil and gas. And oil and gas is the area of international arbitration. You're not going to find a joint operating agreement to develop an oil field or to do exploration without a joint venture agreement with an arbitration clause.
Mm-hmm.
And in Argentina, I had these contracts involving just Argentine corporations in connection with fields that were located in Argentina, but where the applicable law was Texas or Oklahoma law, and you had international arbitration in New York. So, and this is the way how you get into things. You know, maybe approaching to that activity, to a specific activity, takes you to arbitration.
Right.
Yes.
How far does it understand different
I think that each of us can give an answer to that. Maybe Professor Wallace, who's fluent in English and French, and I'm not kidding.
I want to be clear about your question.
I'm just wondering how important it is to speak different languages.
I do think it's important. I think it's important, first and foremost, to be receptive to the idea and to have at least one foreign language. And really the idea is not only to know the language, but to know how to know the language, to be receptive, to understand the approaches for learning, and to think about, and to think about other cultures. And I personally, now remember, I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, so it's not that anybody spoke anything but maybe English, but there. But the idea was that as life moved on, I began to appreciate the importance of language as a window on other cultures, other societies, and then the mastery of one was particularly useful to me, because what happens is that with French and then to some degree with Spanish for me, it allowed me to see what people were actually saying. And that's the thing, not to have a person in the middle who can make all kinds of different, and there are interesting historical accounts of how powerful interpreters have been in history and what impact they've had. But first and foremost, the fact that it makes one receptive to enter into that arena of learning another language, one has to first submit oneself to the notion that there are other cultures, that they are important, and that people may think differently in an organized social and cultural pattern. And then to have the language itself, all you need is a situation where you actually have to apply the language to see how powerful it is. So those are the points that I would make.
Very briefly, I'm embarrassed to say I'm not very strong in any foreign language. I've studied a couple different languages, but Korean and Chinese, and they haven't really applied in my field. I think for my particular job, the languages that I wish that I did have some proficiency in would be French and Spanish. And I'll just tell you a quick story about my old boss, Bart Legum. He was fluent in French, and you know, whenever we were researching a particular issue and couldn't find anything, he had this magic book, and everything was in French, and so I would never be able to understand what was said in this book. But this book seemed to have every case that was ever on point for that obscure issue that we were trying to address, and so he would be able to retrieve that magic case from that magic book. And so if you can be proficient in especially in my particular field, in French and Spanish, then that's going to serve you very well, and that is a huge disadvantage for me.
The only thing I can add, you want to add something also?
Just very, very quickly. ICSID, we have three official languages, English, French, and Spanish. And there you want, quick story. One of the first cases, NAFTA cases, against Mexico. Mm-hmm. The lead counsel for Mexico, an outstanding lawyer, only speaks Spanish all the way through the proceedings. He only speaks Spanish. That's the language of Mexico. He only speaks Spanish. And at a final hearing, he asked for the tribunal permission, said, hey, if you allow me, I'm going to quote Ian Brownlee. And he starts reading in English. The U.S. law firm representing the claimant, they were, wow, he speaks English. He speaks a wonderful English. But the official language of Mexico is Spanish, and he addresses the tribunal in Spanish. They file in Spanish. So it is important. I mean, in our field in particular, it's important to manage foreign languages.
Mm-hmm. And if you can use the language as a tool to understand the foreign legal system, you multiply your knowledge and you multiply your ability to study.
You actually just started to answer my question. I was wondering about, in addition to languages, you work in sort of background in civil law, whether it's from a particular country or civil law in general.
I think my answer would be absolutely yes, not because I come from a civil law background originally, but the good thing about that is that it broadens up your way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it is not a case that necessarily involves the civil law that you're acquainted with.
Right.
It broadens up your mind, and in arbitration, that's the name of the game.
Right. And I would make the point, especially in this field, a lot of things, because it is still, I would say, it's a little bit past its infancy, but it is in the early stages, and a lot of the matters that we face are matters of first impression, and so sometimes you have to argue by analogy, and if you can find something persuasive in the civil law context, then you should use that, you know, in combination with maybe some other sources. So it's definitely useful. We've relied on decisions from every kind of jurisdiction that you can imagine in defending these NAFTA cases.
And if I may add one final point, I'm sorry, Perry, you want to say something?
Just a couple quick points. There's kind of a broad theme here, and it has to do with the fact that there's some things that we are just beginning to catch on with in the United States. You can talk about language, you can talk about cultural awareness, and you can talk about awareness of other legal systems. So why not be ahead of the curve? And, you know, we hope everybody else catches up, but until then, you can be ahead and have a competitive advantage. So even though you have to take the step in regard to learning, you know, civil law, being familiar with civil law, thinking about more openness and learning a language and people to the right and to the left haven't caught on yet and don't have a clue, but you really do have an advantage to the extent that you're willing to do this. And people who are aware know that this is actually a big reality, but it's going to be overwhelming in just a little while.
And in that respect, also, the experience of the business lawyer is so important. You know, the typical scenario is when you are a lawyer from jurisdiction X, but you have to do a deal in jurisdiction Z, and then you hire a local counsel from jurisdiction Z, and when you read the law, because you know another legal system, you can show him, give him ideas about his own legal system that never came through his mind, and maybe you find a creative solution that allows you to have the winning, get that winning edge. So that's... Yes,
scope of the arbitration provision NAFTA, how broad is it? I mean, does it cover any kind of investment in the NAFTA?
In the NAFTA, how broad is it? There's, I think it's 1139. There's an article in the definition section which lists how broad it is, and that's a matter of much controversy and dispute. But there is a provision that does define investment and what the scope of the treaty is. But that's definitely a matter of interpretation in a particular case. Pardon?
Does it exclude
access to local courts?
Does it exclude?
Are you talking about exhaustion of local remedies?
Yeah.
Well, there's actually, it's a little bit different actually in that regard, because you have to make a choice. Instead of going to local court, you can't go to local courts and then go to NAFTA. Instead of doing that, you can bring a NAFTA claim, but you can't do both. So it provides an alternate remedy, and you don't have to necessarily exhaust. I would, maybe before the next question, just while I'm thinking of it, a couple of things. Some of you might have gotten the handouts. I printed out a couple of things that I wanted to share with you. The first is this one, which just provides, it actually shows the link to the U.S. government's website, the State Department's website, and my office. And it has a general description of what my office does, but also the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal and the NAFTA Arbitration Division. And especially the NAFTA page, if you want to learn about international arbitration, we have not just the decisions, but we have all of our briefs. We have all kinds of supplemental information on this site. And one thing I'm very proud of, you know, being on this team, is we've kind of pushed the whole transparency thing, in cooperation with ICSID as well. We've made a lot of this sort of information available to the public so that people can learn about it. Because when I started, it was very difficult to find sources of law in this area, and so that's why people often turn to the Iran-U.S. Claims Tribunal jurisprudence, because that was all that was published out there. But nowadays, you're going to see these decisions and on ICSID's website published, so those are places where you can go to read these decisions to see the kinds of arguments that the parties are making in the cases, because our briefs are here. So I direct you to that. And then the second thing that I brought for you is an article that was written by my former boss with the magic book, Mr. Bart Legum. It was actually written in 2002, but I think it's a very nice introduction to investor-state arbitration under the NAFTA. He kind of points out, I mean, some of it might be a little bit dated, but he does point out some of the controversies which still ring true today associated with it. He also looks at the history, kind of puts it all into context. And I think it's a very nice, short introduction to the area if you're interested in learning more. So I just want to let you know that those are there. Oh, and one more thing, sorry. Because we're talking about opportunities, I thought I should mention to you that my office does hire law clerks. And like I said, we have one here today. And we are in the process of interviewing them. And so if any of you are interested in that sort of thing, you should shoot me an email with a resume, but very quickly, because we're already conducting the interviews, and technically, the process is closed. But when I see such interest, this is the kind of thing that I want to encourage, and I'd certainly love to consider anybody here who's interested for a law clerk position in our office. So if you are interested, maybe come talk to me, and I can give you my email address and maybe put it on the board or something like that. But I would encourage you to apply.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It seems to me, based on what I've heard, that there's kind of two avenues of getting into the field. Kind of get yourself settled with a base of a broad international business law experience, and then kind of go into the commercial arbitration, the arbitration field. Or it's almost that kind of by law, at least based by what the panel was. But in terms of kind of, are law firms open to a more directed route, even from the get-go, of saying, look, this is what I want to learn? Or is it really kind of having it in your head that that's where you want to get, and have it be that second step?
I think you can do both. And it also depends on what you have to offer to that firm. I mean, if you're a very attractive candidate to them, that's something you can negotiate with them. And one caveat I should mention, just because I just know from others' experience, there are a lot of law firms right now. There are some that have a lot of these cases. There are others that have a practice and have a dream and a goal and a wish to get some business in this area, but don't necessarily have the clients right now, and so they might offer you a position in that kind of role, but then not have the cases, and you end up doing, you know, more traditional litigation. So just keep that in mind. You want to research the law firm that you apply to and see what they actually have. But in your negotiation with them, you know, when you're in the job offer stage, it's certainly not going to hurt to be clear. This is a very popular area. A lot of people ask for this kind of work, though, so keep that in mind. Mm-hmm.
But there is also the cultural thing. Mm-hmm. The United States is such a big country. For instance, if you're a Hispanic, you should consider Miami law firms, Texas law firms, because they have a lot of Latin American law firms. And so you also have to look at your background and see how you can better capitalize on your background.
Mm-hmm.
And the language, is, of course, important and things like that. Not that that's the only way of doing it, but that's one of the ideas. Yes.
Only U.S. citizens.
We've
had to turn down really strong candidates in the past, and it's been unfortunate. Yes, I should have mentioned that as well. Sorry.
What about internships? Even if they're
unpaid. It's something that we can look into. We've looked into that in the past for someone. And it didn't end up working out, but I'm certainly willing to look at that more closely. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Gonzalo.
I'm sorry,
Gonzalo.
I'm sorry.
Very common mistake. Don't worry.
Your office officer,
yeah, let me put it this way. My mentor and deputy secretary general of ICSID announced his retirement in March 2005. We have still not replaced him. I don't know. I don't know where we are right now. Usually my answer would be no, we do not have interns. But to give, for example, things change all the time in ICSID. And last year we started, this not apply to any of you, but we started with a paralegal program, college graduate. And some of us said, no, this is not helpful. And it was fantastic. These kids will go to law school now. They are fantastic. So I don't know. I interviewed somebody yesterday for an internship. I didn't know we'd give you an internship.
You know, if any of you are part-time students, though, that's something to think about, because it just occurred to me as well. We're looking for a paralegal on the NAFTA team right now, and if you were a part-time student, you could come work for us full-time, and you would learn a lot. Our paralegals are incredible. Our paralegal that's leaving us now is a law student, and that's what we prefer to hire, is an evening student who can come because they're more motivated, you know, they're interested and they want to learn. And so that's the kind of person that we're looking for to replace our current paralegal, who's been fabulous. And honestly, if there was an open entry-level position, I know if it was my decision, I would hire her in a heartbeat. She's incredible. So she's going off to a clerkship for now. But so you know, if you're an evening student and that's something you're interested in, also let me know.
Yes, and there are also different levels of internships. The International Court of Arbitration of the International Chamber of Commerce in Paris has an internship program. It's a two-month stay in Paris. We have the program of the International Arbitration Program of the Washington College of Law has an arrangement with the ICC,
okay.
And which is open for applicants who are at the graduate level, who have had some exposure to arbitration, especially along the lines that have been described to you by many of the panel speakers today, having written an article, having written an LLM paper in the area of arbitration, having taken a specialized course in arbitration. So this is also an opportunity, and this opportunity is available to our program.
Would you advise your students, for example, to go into, for example, the Better Business Bureau and do some arbitration work for the three bases and then use that as a stepping stone? I mean, because there are certain organizations in D.C. that have voluntary arbitration courses. And I think it's just quite good.
All experience is good and positive, but we are talking about international arbitration here. That can be a first step. But international arbitration is very different from domestic arbitration. There are similarities, but there are differences. Professor Wallace put it very clearly, it's a combination of flexibility and structure. And that is a very delicate balance in an international case. Because flexibility means that you do not have to abide by any specific procedural rule of law. And it means that there is a lot of liberty, and there is nothing more scary than how to use your liberty. But at the same time, it is a structure, because international arbitration is private justice, but arbitrators lack imperium. They cannot enforce their decisions, so they depend on national courts of law. And you cannot do things that are go against certain basic public policy principles that are followed and enforced by national courts of law. And then in addition to that, you have the parties who appointed you, and by that, they expect you to do certain things. So you are like the piece of meat in the hamburger. You have the national legal court system, you have the private parties, and you have liberty, but you have constraints. And in an international case, that requires to balance out, to juggle with many different things. So a domestic arbitration experience is very useful, but it's not enough. It's just the first step. Yes?
The New York Bar, member of the New York Bar, compared to other bars, does that confer an advantage in the arbitration, international commercial arbitration? Someone told me that it did, and I don't know if that's true.
It's probably a coincidence just that a lot of people that do international commercial arbitration are in New York, but I don't know. I mean, you might know better than I do.
Well,
I am
a member of the New York Bar. To me, to go through the bar exam was a very interesting and useful experience as a lawyer in general. It adds up, but that doesn't turn you or give you a special advantage as an arbitrator. There are excellent arbitrators who never went to the New York Bar,
mm-hmm.
who are not even American.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it is a very positive experience, especially if you come from a continental law system.
Mm-hmm.
Because it forces you to absorb a certain level of knowledge on an Anglo-Saxon system. In addition to that, it's a very important thing to have if you're considering being admitted to an American law firm, starting a career on an American law firm.
Now, I noticed that a lot of international commercial contracts have a choice of forum clause, such as New York. How does that affect? I mean, do I have to be a New York Bar member to go there and do?
Well, you have to be a member of the bar to litigate.
Mm-hmm.
Can I be a California bar member and go to New York and participate in a
like in an enforcement proceeding,
right.
Or in the arbitration? You know, I don't practice in commercial arbitration, but I think in the arbitration itself, it's not required. But if you're talking about the proceedings to either enforce or set aside awards in U.S. court, you'd need to be a member of the bar. But I'm a member of the California Bar, for example, and because I work at the State Department, I represent the government in these arbitrations, I'm not in U.S. court at all. So I don't. It doesn't matter for me.
And as just a final thought on that, in international investment arbitration, as a general rule, what you're expected to have is to have one bar, to be a lawyer.
Right.
But it's all about flexibility. I know, of course, a distinguished practitioner who has five bars.
Collecting.
Usually New York, Paris, London, but one bar. You have to be a lawyer, and that's it.
You can always
wave into D.C. too, then you can get two.
You think it's a good time to move to the to have a bite and continue the conversation in an even more informal way?
Well,
thank you so much.
Let's move.
It's not an offer.
We have to go. I don't know anything about this stuff.
The thing is that sometimes when we're interviewing, people come, oh, but she doesn't know. Look, Antonio Farrah, Margaret Stevens, and so forth.
Yeah,
wait,
yeah. Right.
How are you?
But now you can
see.
Now, yeah, now we are all listening.
Oh,
yeah,
do you?
I know.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you so much. I should have.
Yeah.
Thank you in front of everybody.
Oh.
Yeah,
that's
interesting place to work.
Hi.
Yeah, I've worked with him a number of years.
I'm good.
Well,
how are you?
I'm in the office.
Hi.
I'm good.
Thank you
very much. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah, good place to work. Very good. I'm glad you like the program.
Oh, really? Are you a partner?
I mean, I'm an alumni, so
yeah.
They just email.
I think
that's really good.
Yeah.
But then again, when I finish here, I do the
And honestly, I don't know where that stands right now, but I know that I have permission to ask people if they're interested, and I don't know ultimately if we're going to jingle a lawsuit, but I'm advocating for it. So I would encourage you if I do want my email address.
When I heard that you were going to be interested, I had
We have hearings that are starting in May and continuing probably May of next year. Too bad I didn't meet you sooner. We've needed Farsi translators for things, and we didn't find enough people. So somebody with that background, it's a wonderful asset for you to have for my office. For investors, for this kind of arbitration, for that Iran-U.S. claims tribunal stuff, Farsi is the language. That's great. Well, I will let people know about you, and please send me a resume. Briefly in your email, you can kind of treat that as a cover letter, and I'll be in touch and let you know where things are with that. Okay? Great. The law firm thing? Okay. All right. I'll let them know. The law firm position is 20 hours a week, and there's also extern positions. There's a variety of different positions that you can get in my office. I didn't talk about it here, but it was in the docket today. Instead of doing this investor space stuff, I've transferred it to, you need diversity in life, right? So I do, I'm in charge of and I'm doing a lot of stuff now, and I'm going to have my own extern for the summer, but it's not for pay, it's for credit. And I'm preferring to, Copper has a seminar this summer that is done in conjunction with a job in government. And so I'm giving preference to those students, but I've posted an advertisement about it today. That has my email address on it too, by the way. So if you wanted to call into arbitration indirectly, that's a way in the doing tours is actually, I think, fascinating because it's human drama. This is all about money and feeling gone bad and things like that. Tours is definitely about, I don't know, so-and-so who saved me, so-and-so, horrible car accident, but it's international. Because our, it's not in Tourist Act, but it's actually, when a tourist is committed abroad, the United States is not liable, but we do have the authority to pay those claims by using discretion if we'd like, and so what I have to do is when an incident like that happens abroad, I have to look at all of the factors, and I get to decide do we want to pay and they're sometimes really politically charged and sensitive, and so it's more fact-based problem-solving than law, and the investor state stuff is more kind of academic, very challenging and interesting all over.
Especially when traveling is fun, but work is not that fun. Oh, yeah, work is demanding. But, you know, it's still useful, especially if you come back real quick.
Oh, that's a good
curious to wrap it up. Moving into